Today at Reader's Corner, David Robertson, author of Brick by Brick, How Lego Rewrote the Rules of Innovation and Conquered the Global Toy Industry.
Once they decided who their customers were, then they started creating stories and games and other things around the brick and doing much more focused testing. They're in such a competitive industry with fickle customers, and you have to redo your product line every year just to stay alive. They've lost all their patent protection, and yet they're growing at 24% in sales and 40% in profits every year. Kind of an amazing story. But the question is, how long can Lego keep up this growth path if they don't come up with the big innovation?
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. It's hard to imagine a world without Legos. The plastic building blocks have been a foundation of children's imaginative play for nearly 60 years. But back in 2009, Lego nearly was no more. After enjoying years of success, the company found itself in the midst of a digital revolution that had changed the nature of play and made the company's most reliable customers, 10-year-old boys, a lot more fickle. Global competition also had heated up, and in 1998, Lego suffered its first major loss in company history. Lego relied upon some traditional innovation strategies to launch a recovery, but they left the company flailing and on the doorstep of bankruptcy. In Brick by Brick, How Lego Rewrote the Rules of Innovation and Conquered the Global Toy Industry, David Robertson shares the company's storied history, reveals how Lego again thrives, and offers tips for companies and organizations of all shapes and sizes that seek to grow. The book's co-author is Bill Breen. Brick by Brick is now out in paperback. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with David Robertson. He is a professor of practice at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. From 2002 through 2010, he was the Lego Professor of Innovation and Technology Management at Switzerland's Institute for Management Development. Dr. Robertson joins us today by phone for this interview. David Robertson, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, Dave, when I read your book, I felt like I was getting two for the price of one, because in many ways, I think this is two books. The one is a fascinating narrative of the history of a company that had to reinvent itself as times changed. It tracks leadership succession from the early days when it was family-owned to today when professional managers have taken over. But it's also a management primer on innovation and how to sustain companies through the years. And I'd like to touch on both of those. We can't do justice to both of those in 30 minutes, but that's the reason why we urge our listeners to get this book. But let's get back to Lego and talk about the basic icon. What is so special about the Lego brick that we're all so familiar with? After all, it's just a piece of plastic. What makes it what it is?
Well, I think it's the idea of a system of play rather than a toy. And I think that was one of the great innovations of Lego. And it actually came from outside the company. It was a conversation between the son of the founder, a guy named Godfred Christensen, and somebody from a department store. And the guy from the department store was saying, you know, we don't need another toy. We don't need another box on the shelf. What we need is a system of play, something where if you bought two or three sets, they'd fit together. And every time you'd add a set, it would multiply the possibilities. And Godfred and the company had been experimenting around with a stackable brick, but it was a small part of what they were making. But after that conversation, he went back and he thought about what would a system of play mean. And over the next couple of years, focused all his attentions on the brick and patented the brick we know now in 1958, and then the company took off from there.
Mm-hmm. Well, how has Lego managed to gain such loyalty from its fans, especially in the face of competition from others?
So Lego went through this period of, well, first they went through a period of growth from the late 70s through the early 90s, and then they went through a stagnant period in the mid-90s, and they really began to worry about the company in the late 90s, as many companies did, with the focus on the internet and digital and virtual play experiences. And so they began to experiment and focus, the focus of the company moved away from the brick. They thought the brick was passé. And they ended up, looking at electronic toys and digital play experiences and all kinds of things like that. And a lot of them that they brought to market just weren't that good and weren't that profitable and weren't successful. that led the company to near bankruptcy in 2003. But something they learned from that whole experience is that actually the virtual doesn't disrupt the physical. That if kids play an online game with little Lego minifigures, like Lego Indiana Jones or Lego Batman or Lego Star Wars, they want more bricks, not less. And that it complements the play. That if you get kids involved in a story, and then they can build that story with bricks and play it out with their own little minifigures, it deepens the involvement with a toy. And so what Lego learned during that period, very painfully learned, was that while the parents may buy the bricks and the system of play, what really attracts the kids are the stories. And so Lego continues to license intellectual properties like, of course, Star Wars and Batman and others. But they also create their own. So they had a big hit that I talk about in the book called Ninjago. They followed that with The Legends of Chima, and there's stories and cartoons and behind these that involve kids as well as games. That is what I think leads to Lego's success, is that they're not really focused on the brick, but they're focused on creating really compelling stories that draw kids in and make them want to build with the brick.
Mm-hmm. You talk in your book about the seven truths of innovation, and as it turns out, those were seven truths that Lego followed but also strayed from. And let's just take this one, be customer-driven. I think your point here is that you listen to your customers and you learn what the next product is by what the kids are saying.
Yeah, so they found that when they did some market research that most kids don't actually like construction toys. There's a lot of kids that just aren't interested in building with bricks. And so they started creating Lego toys. This was during that experimentation period I talked about between 99 and 2002. They started creating toys that didn't involve much building, much construction. And those were pretty unsuccessful. I mean, they might have succeeded if they'd had a different brand on it, but both the toy buyers and the parents would look at a toy with the Lego brand on it and kind of get confused if it didn't have any construction experience. So they really lost their way for a while. What they did to get that back, though, was once they decided who their customers were, you know, that it was kids who like building stuff, then they started really focusing on what makes those kids excited. And they started creating stories and games and other things around the brick and doing much more focused testing at every step in the process to make sure the kids really were excited about the toys that they were going to come out with. And that's led to much more successful toys.
One of the other seven truths of innovation is head for blue ocean markets. What's a blue ocean market? And I think you use Quicken and Southwest Airlines as examples of companies that sailed to blue ocean markets.
Yeah, so blue ocean, the metaphor is that there's two different kinds of oceans. One is red ocean, and red oceans are red because the competition is so fierce in the ocean. There's sharks circling, and you know, all the fish in the sea are attacking each other, and the waters run red with blood. If instead, as a business, if you can find an underserved market segment, somebody that's not finding the products or services that they want, then you can have that ocean to yourself. You can have that market to yourself, and it's blue ocean, and you're going to get a lot more growth and profitability if you sail for that ocean. The authors have identified, you know, some examples like Southwest Airlines that the traditional airlines were only serving the business traveler, and Southwest Airlines with their point-to-point rather than a hub-and-spoke model and their focus on the everyday traveler, the leisure traveler, was able to put together an offering for that underserved market segment and have a piece of the market to themselves. Lego, in searching for Blue Ocean, you know, the problem was that in their core market of brick-based physical construction toys, they're the shark. You know, they have 80% plus of that market, and sharks love red ocean. If you're the great white shark, the place you want to be is red ocean. And by sailing away and only focusing on blue oceans, the whole company moved away from the core market. And when they moved back, what they found is that they really liked that red ocean of construction toys. And you know, when you're the shark, that's the place you want to be.
You're listening to David C. Robertson. He's the author of Brick by Brick, how Lego rewrote the rules of innovation and conquered the global toy industry. Well, Clayton Christensen popularized the term disruptive innovation, among others, and that's another one of those seven truths of innovation. That may be one of those that work both ways for Lego. It may have gotten them off track a bit. Help us understand the role that disruptive innovation played for Lego.
Yeah, disruptive innovation is kind of the other half of the coin of revolutionary types of innovation, whereas blue ocean is, you know, let's find some new market that we can serve that nobody's serving. Disruptive innovation, the theory that Christensen and his colleagues have put forward is that often in your current market, what can happen is a new technology or a new business model can come out. And what happens is that it can start as being a very low-end, cheap, low-quality type of solution. And so the incumbents ignore it, and they focus on the main part of the market, the more profitable end of the market. But technology can change really rapidly, and before you know it, it's taken over. And this happened to Kodak, of course, that initially digital cameras took pretty bad pictures. And even though each picture was much cheaper, it was a low-quality picture. And so Kodak, making so much money from film, ignored it completely until it was too late. And, you know, they owned some of the early patents. They knew more about digital photography than anybody else, but they squashed it out, and before they knew it, they were disrupted. So Lego was really worried, and as many companies were in the late 90s, that the virtual and the digital was going to disrupt the physical, and that kids were going to move away, not just from Lego, but from, you know, Hot Wheels and Barbie and all the other traditional toys. And so they spent a lot of money trying to develop virtual play experiences. And again, you know, what they found is that it doesn't disrupt, that in fact it complements, and that kids want more bricks.
So at one point, Lego decided they probably ought to get into the video gaming business. And this may be an example of where you're disrupting a little too much along the innovation lines. Tell us that story.
Yeah, so they came back to this later, that they really did want to explore virtual building experiences. And so they spent a tremendous amount of money trying to develop a multiplayer online game called Lego Universe. And Lego Universe, the whole idea was, I think, brilliant and well-targeted, which is let's let kids get together online and let's give them challenges, and the only way to solve that challenge is to build something with virtual Lego bricks. And then as they solve those challenges, they get an area where they can take back bricks that they pick up in their adventures and start to build amazing things in these areas and that they can show off to each other. But if you go through, as we do in the book, and you look at Christensen's theory of disruptive innovation and all the things to do and to not do, Lego does everything wrong. You know, they basically manage this very different business the same way they manage their core brick business. And they push the technology much too hard, much beyond what it can do. And they try and apply their standards for quality to this, what is still a fairly low quality technology. You know, you can't have a Lego brick with little Lego logos on each stud on top of it. And you can't draw thousands of those on a computer and expect to be able to move through the environment with those bricks surrounding it. And so they ended up with a game that just wasn't that fun. They priced it wrong. They developed it wrong. And they spent a lot of money on it. And they ended up closing it down after a little over a year, about 14 months. And so it really was Lego's attempt at a different experience, a disruptive virtual play experience that failed dramatically.
One of the other truths of innovation centers around that question of whether or not it's possible to teach individual team members in a company how to innovate or whether to create a culture of innovation. And as I understand it, Lego lands on this innovation culture approach, which you might want to help us understand.
Yeah, that's one of those really fuzzy terms. Let's build an innovation culture. A lot of people talk about it. You know, if you Google it, you get all kinds of people talking about how important it is to have an innovation culture. The danger with that term is that too often it's meant to signify a creative culture. You know, let's have a culture where it's okay to come up with lots of different ideas and be creative and experiment. And the problem with that, at least for Lego, is that during that experimentation period between 1999 and 2002, you know, they really encourage their people to come up with the next great play experience, and you know, don't involve the brick. I mean, the cooler stuff was the virtual and digital stuff, and they really left the brick behind, and the company was out of control, and there wasn't enough discipline and structure around making sure that it was something the kids would actually want and that would make money for the company. Now, if you come into Lego, you're still challenged to be creative, but you're challenged to be creative within much more disciplined and structured boundaries. You're challenged to come up with a great police station or fire truck or you know, play theme like Ninjago. And you're given pretty tight targets on, you know, what shapes and colors you can use and what the profitability of your set should be and when it should be ready for reviews by management. And, you know, there's lots of discipline and structure around it. And so I would call what Lego is now an innovation culture, because it's a culture where teams are given both the space to be creative, but also the direction to deliver. And I think that's really what an innovation culture means. And Lego's culture in 2000 and 2001 was really a creative culture, but it wasn't an innovative culture.
Well, you refer at one point to a runaway innovation. And I wonder if you could explain that, if somebody's listening who has a company and they're all about innovating. What's the dangers and what is the runaway innovation?
Well, for Lego, it ran away in every direction. I mean, they came up with play experiences that weren't very good. There was a toy called Galador, which had a TV show along with it and a video game and a set of toys and little electronics in the toys and a talkback technology. So that if you watch the TV show with a toy, it would talk back to the TV show. And it was just bad. I mean, I looked it up on IMDb, and nobody who acted in the TV show ever acted in anything ever again. I mean, Lego got out of businesses it understood into areas that it really wasn't very good at. Same with electronic toys and other areas that, you know, in some cases, by reaching too far away from its core, it ended up trying to do things that it wasn't very good at. In some cases, some of the toys might have been good, but they just weren't appropriate for the brand. They ended up with toys that, you know, just weren't very Lego-y. And in other cases, they ended up with toys that didn't sell that well. And Lego is a fixed cost business. It takes a lot of money to build those factories that pump out those plastic parts. And if you sell a lot of toys, you end up making a lot of money. But if you don't sell enough, you end up losing a lot of money. And so they ended up making toys that just weren't that popular and so weren't that profitable. And so it was runaway in every sense of the word. Mm-hmm. And like I said, they almost went bankrupt in 2003 because of it.
And you use the word core. That seems to be one of the central messages of this book. And, of course, you can pick up so many management primers and read about this. But having you lay it out the way Lego walked away from those core values, it really is all about not forgetting what those are, isn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see what the next book about Lego is. And, you know, let me talk about that because
sure.
It is one of the later chapters in the book. But, you know, I think Lego is an amazing story because it's a company, you know, the latest statistics are it's been growing sales at 24% per year, every year for the last 5 years. And growing profits at 40% per year, every year for the last 5 years. And it's doing that without any real revolutionary innovations. There's no big breakthroughs by Lego. It's putting together boxes of bricks and selling them. And that's pretty amazing. I mean, how many companies listening would happily trade their financial results for Legos over the last 5 years? But what's interesting is that if you look at a lot of the business press about innovation, it's all about, you know, big game-changing products, the iPod, the iPhone, the iPad, and not about those little innovations that Lego is so good at, putting a story together with a game, together with a box of bricks, together with events around the country, and making something like Ninjago a multi-billion dollar hit. I mean, that's really lots of little innovations that go well together. But the question is, how long can Lego keep up this growth path if they don't come up with the big innovation. You know, sooner or later, they've got to come up with the next big construction experience. And they've tried. They had a little hit in the book that I talk about in the book called Lego Games, and they had a big failure, this online multiplayer Lego Universe game. But at some point, the string's going to run out, and we're going to be talking about how, you know, Lego had a good run and how because of their inability to do the big innovations, you know, they really didn't go any further. But that said, I think that any business can learn a lot from, you know, how do you innovate around the core? How do you put together lots of little low-risk innovations that complement each other and together make this unbeatable package and this tremendous growth? You know, Lego is a wonderful story about that.
You're listening to David C. Robertson. He's the author of Brick by Brick, How Lego Rewrote the Rules of Innovation and Conquered the Global Toy Industry. And he wrote this book with Bill Breen. So why isn't Lego publicly traded, and why doesn't Wall Street pay a little bit more attention?
It's still mostly owned by the family. It does report its results. You know, we'll see. The third generation of the family is transferring control to the fourth generation of the family. And the third generation, in the person of Kjell Kirk Christensen, the grandson of the founder, has been very involved in the business, ran it for 20 years, and is still around the company a lot. But, you know, we'll see whether the fourth generation wants to remain involved or whether they want to cash out and make it a publicly traded company. We could be seeing something in the next, you know, 5 or 10 years, some change in ownership. But until it is publicly traded, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to write the book is that I've looked at half a dozen different lists of the most innovative companies in the world, and Lego isn't on any of them. They don't make the top 50 on any list I have ever found. And that's kind of amazing, given that they're in such a competitive industry with fickle customers, and you have to redo your product line every year or two just to stay alive. They've lost all their patent protection. Everybody else can make a brick cheaper than Lego, and many do, and yet they're growing at 24% in sales and 40% of profits every year. It's kind of an amazing story.
That is indeed an amazing story. What about this first Lego League competitions? Is that another effort on their part to trying to stay ahead of the curve?
So first Lego League is a competition, which if you haven't seen one, I urge you to go see it. It's a competition where they get kids together, kind of high school kids together, to build Lego robots and navigate a set of challenges that's different every year. I coached my son's team when he was at that age, and it's a really a wonderful way to teach kids about robotics in an accessible and fun kind of tournament style. I think the Lego robotics kit is one of the better investments you can make in your kid's ability to support you when you're older. I mean, it teaches a great set of very marketable skills.
I was fascinated by that period in Lego's history where they got into architecture, the Sears Tower and what have you. Tell us how that happened, and is that still alive and well in the Lego business?
Oh, very much so. That's done tremendously well. Yeah, that's a great example, I think, of open innovation, something where they tried it before and it didn't work. But they, what happened was, there was a guy, Paul Smith Meyer from Lego, who was walking around a Lego fan convention where Lego fans, adult fans, show off their creations, and met this architect from Chicago named Adam Reed Tucker that started building, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9 foot tall versions of famous architectural landmarks like the Sears Tower in Chicago, which I guess is now the Willis Tower. Because he felt, as an architect, if he wanted to explain the structure of buildings, you had to make it at a more accessible size, and that Lego was a great medium to use to explain how skyscrapers are structured. And so they began to have a conversation, this guy from Lego and this Chicago architect, and they talked about could they put together a series of kits designed by this architect to have famous landmarks. And so Lego actually, and I think this was a pretty big move by a company, they started publishing somebody else's Lego-designed kits. You know, that's big. You know, rather than creating their own, they were taking somebody else's design, putting their signature on the box, and selling them under a different brand. But it's been phenomenally successful. It's done very well. You can see them going to any Barnes & Noble, and you'll see a bunch of Lego architecture kits for sale.
So what's the future of Legoland? And help us understand how many Legolands are out there these days.
So Legoland is a set of theme parks that were designed to appeal to the core Lego fan. You know, most theme parks are more targeted toward teenagers with scary roller coasters and other things. Legolands are much tamer. So that core Lego audience of kind of 5 to 9 year olds is thrilled to go to a Legoland. And they also have lots of displays of Lego. And as you're waiting for a ride, there's big bins of bricks that you can play with. And it's a lot of fun if your kids are that age. They'd had one in the headquarters, near the headquarters in Billund, Denmark, for a number of years, since the 60s. And during their experimentation period, they expanded into the UK, the US, and Germany. And again, into businesses they didn't understand. And the theme park business, it turns out it takes a while for a theme park to get up to scale. And it just sucks cash while it's starting out. You know, you have to spend a lot of money to get it up and going. And then once it is up and going, it really is a very good business. But it was another area where they just realized we should not be in this business. We don't understand it. We can't manage it well. And so they sold the majority ownership of the parks to somebody else after the near brush with bankruptcy. And it's been doing very well since and expanding steadily since.
So do I have time for one more question? And it's going to go back to your point about what's the next big thing for Lego. It seems to me from watching my grandchildren play, it's all about competing with Xbox. I mean, somebody's going to have to figure out a way at Lego to do something that's digital. Now, they have already, of course, but what's your thoughts on how they view this issue of kids these days being so hooked up? Games, video, electronics, and that's not what the core value of Lego was all about.
Well, I can't say anything about their future plans, you know, because of NDA. But as I do say in the book, they have experimented with virtual experiences and failed. Meanwhile, over in Sweden, there was a part-time programmer named Marcus Persson who invented a game called Minecraft, which is really Lego-y. I mean, you build with blocks in a virtual space, and you can get together with friends, and people are doing amazing things in Minecraft. There's entire recreations of the world of Westeros from Game of Thrones, or there's another group that's getting together and building all of Middle Earth from the Lord of the Rings trilogy, and they're just doing incredible things. And it's moving over into the Lego space because there was a fan of Minecraft who created this ability to grab any Minecraft creation and send it over to a 3D printer and print it out of Lego plastic or metal or anything else. And so I gave my son a $100 Lego kit, the architecture kit for Falling Water. And he made it in Minecraft over a couple days, and then we sent it down to my MakerBot 3D printer and printed it out of Lego plastic for about $8. I think it's a threat. I think you can really see some kind of set where you come out with a couple basic bricks that you can make for just as cheap or cheaper than Lego, but then you sell it along with a low-end 3D printer that can make shapes that snap onto those, and so you can design whatever castle or police station or fire truck you want, and it comes with a whole set of basic shapes, but you can add your own and print it out and make whatever you want. I think that's a threat to Lego because it would be cheaper, bigger, better, and just as creative. And so who knows how this will all play out, but I think there's some real threats. I know Lego's aware of them. But they've got to come out with the next big thing at some point because they can't keep up this growth forever around just this core business of bricks.
Well, there's a look into the future. And the book is Brick by Brick, How Lego Rewrote the Rules of Innovation and Conquered the Global Toy Industry. David C. Robertson is the author with Bill Breen. Dave, thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thanks, Bob. I enjoyed it.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with David Robertson. Next week, Peter Stark, author of Astoria, John Jacob Astor and Thomas Jefferson's Lost Pacific Empire, a story of wealth, ambition, and survival. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.